I used to walk around and say, I don't judge anyone except Christians.
I remember a magistrate saying, you're not listening to anything we're trying to do, you're going to prison, son.
People are mysteries and also infinitely valuable in that way.
Then they tell you you'll probably be dead within 27 months.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart. When I was younger, lots of people, and I did this myself, would head off overseas for long journeys, backpacking around the world, and occasionally you'd hear people say, I'm going to find myself. That was the line. I understood the concept. It was this thought that I somehow have to travel in order to find out who I really am. Who am I at the core of myself? This reminds me of a phrase I've been hearing a little bit lately, you do you. I mean, what does that really mean? I mean, I have an idea of who I am, but do I really know myself that well? Do we know ourselves all that well? It seems that this is a sort of variation on the age-old motivational adages, follow your heart, be true to yourself, which you still hear in school assemblies and speech days these days. And it is one of the key questions or concepts of our culture, identity. Who am I? Well, Brian Rosner is the principal of Ridley College in Melbourne, Australia, and the author of Known by God, a biblical theology of personal identity. We'll get into his book a little later on, and his own story about losing and finding his identity. But we started by talking to Brian about why identity is such a big deal in the first place.
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One would be that personal autonomy, making decisions for yourself, is at the centre of so many different debates. So assisted dying, for example, it's all about a person's own choices being paramount. And that's true of all sorts of different questions that are debated in society. And the other thing to say is that the advice you often hear is that you need to be true to yourself and follow your heart. So Donald Trump, for example, at his first graduation commencement speech at Liberty University, said to the bright-eyed graduates, be true to yourself and your country, always be sure to be yourself. And that's the message that we hear repeatedly in all sorts of ways.
And in some cases, that's sort of dubious advice.
Well, it can be. It depends who you are, of course. Right. I mean, if I'm a workaholic or an abusive spouse or a selfish so-and-so, being true to myself is not a great idea, is it?
No. So how do people typically form their identity today? And how is that different from previous eras?
Well, the way we think about identity today in general in the West is that the most profound, important answers to the big questions are inside yourself. You need to look inside and follow your heart, that idea. The odd thing I find is that even though there's such a weight of importance put on knowing who you are and acting accordingly, a lot of people don't know who they are anymore. So in the past, you'd sort of have this narrative in your life. You'd get your identity from your parents, maybe revise it in your adolescence. If you're unlucky, you had a midlife crisis, then you retired and that was you. But these days, people are questioning who they are at many points. There's something called the thrisis in your 30s, where you climb the ladder of success and find out it's leaning against the wrong building. There's cuspiety. So when the cusp ages come, you kind of think, oh my goodness, what's happening to my life? And there's this uncertainty, and in a sense that's part of the deal, because you can invent yourself. You're meant to define yourself. So throughout your life you might express yourself in so many different ways that go to the very question of your identity.
Now, in the past you mentioned you had sort of a set identity at some level. Perhaps you followed your father becoming the dairy farmer or the carpenter or whatever it might have been. It's not all bad, is it, that we've moved away from that and people have a certain amount of autonomy, have an ability to construct their story for themselves to some degree. That's not all negative, is it?
No, not at all. And I think it has opened up possibilities, as you say, and people have got lots and lots of choices now. There can be an unrealistic expectation about those choices, a kind of sense of entitlement, that everything's going to go very smoothly. But I think that there is a limitation to this idea of finding yourself and expressing yourself, because most of us realise that we need others to define ourselves. So we know ourselves by being known by others, our best friends, close family members and so on. The fact that my father was a refugee from Europe and lived in China for 10 years and then came to Australia. Somehow that affects who I am today, even though it's before I existed. It affects my attitudes and my tastes and some of my values. So the idea that you simply write your own story from when you were born to when you die is a bit of a fallacy.
Yeah, there's a bit of truth to, in any sort of self-knowledge, having the perspective of other people, right? So I might think of myself as one thing, but you know and can give me a different perspective on myself.
Absolutely. And do we really know ourselves that well? Just a banal illustration would be when I go clothes shopping, I go into the change room and I just get this view of myself, me front on in reverse. And if there are mirrors around the sides, I'm taken aback and think, who's that? But the truth is, other people know me very well. And back in 1902, psychologists coined the term the looking glass self. So you know yourself by being aware of the opinion of others reflected back to you. So there is a sense in which we're all social beings at the core, and defining yourself on your own is unrealistic.
I've heard you say that there's a bit of a loss associated with defining yourself apart from any sort of bigger story, and that seems to be a modern problem.
Well, the modern approach is you write your own story, and that sounds very attractive, but in the end, it can be very difficult because all of our lives have what you might call unscripted moments, things that don't go according to plan. And many people have aspirations that aren't realised, the destiny they were looking for just doesn't happen. And then, of course, at the end of life, death robs us of our identity and our accomplishments.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. There's this great scene in the movie Zoolander that I just love. You might have seen it. You remember this male model is having an identity crisis. He stares into the heavens and he asks,
"Who am I?"
Hello? Derek, you hearing me?
God?
Well, clearly, that wasn't God. But being known by God is not just the topic of Brian Rosner's book. It's one of the key threads in the story of his life. He lived through losing his identity and finding it again.
Back in the mid-90s, I was living in Scotland and teaching at the University of Aberdeen and was married with three children. And my wife left me and I was on my own with the kids for several years. Ended up moving back to Australia and took a job as a school teacher. So some big parts of my life changed quite dramatically, and from my point of view, quite unexpectedly. And that, I think, drove down into the core of my being, had me asking questions that I didn't think I'd ever be asking. And the most basic one is, who am I then? If the story of my life has taken such a dramatic turn, and the ways in which I've defined myself in the past have now changed fully. Who am I? That was a question I came to.
Did you feel like a lot of the things that had been foundational to you had been kind of ripped away?
Yes, and I remember one incident in Scotland. I was sitting in the car waiting for the engine to warm up to demist the windscreen. And I looked up at the rear view mirror and adjusted and looked and wondered, who's that? There's a psychological term for that. It's just an emotional state, dissociation. So it got pretty bad. What settled me was the way in which I, even if I didn't know who I was, my closest friends reflected back to me my identity and reassured me, if you like. So Peter and Sheena had me over for meals. Richard took me for walks. And a good friend, Frank, rang me every Sunday night. And then in an even more profound sense, I came back to the Bible as a Bible scholar, and I noticed a theme that is largely hidden, namely this idea of being known by God, that being known by God gives us a secure and stable identity. So my life is hidden with Christ in God. That idea became very important for me. It didn't have me jumping out of bed whistling a happy tune, but I think it helped me in the sense that the pessimism that might have engulfed me was doused, and I was able to carry on.
Everything you've talked about in terms of reforming your identity is relational. So relational things with other people, but also with your belief in your relationship with God.
Yes, and I think that's true of personal identity. So we come to know ourselves by being known by persons other than ourselves. And perhaps one way of thinking about it that's helpful is we know our children. So our children, especially our young, when they're young, are known by us. And what that does for them is it gives them a secure identity. So psychologists talk about attachment theory. So having that firm, secure attachment to your main caregivers gives you a stable and satisfying sense of self. And I think my experience, and from the Christian point of view, that's the kind of relationship we have with God, where he knows us as his children and gives us an identity that can withstand the knocks of life.
Tell us a bit more about this concept of being known by God, and what difference does that make in someone's life?
Well, I think in terms of personal identity, being known is fundamental, and there's a great illustration of that. There was a chap called Christopher Knight in the US who went off on his own, parked his car, wandered off into the wilderness in the state of Maine, and 27 years later he emerged. He'd been arrested by the police for stealing from cabins in the mountains. So he hadn't seen anyone for that period of time. From the world's point of view, he didn't exist. What's interesting is, from his own point of view, he didn't exist. So he was interviewed later about the perception he'd gained from his solitude. And he said that he had just no one to perform for, no one to be connected with, so he had no need for an identity. So I think at root, that's true of all human beings. We're social beings, and our identity is formed in relationship with other people, not only in knowing them, but in them knowing us. So when I had my own crisis of identity, there was a sense in which knowing God had been something that removed, from my point of view, from my life, futility. It gave a sense of purpose and direction. But when things hit the fan, that didn't help me much at all. There was a sense in which I needed reassurance about my sense of self, and that came from being known. So the theme of being known by God is a wonderful one right throughout the Bible, quite profound and intimate and personal. So Paul talks about the fact that being known by God is more important than knowing God, and God knows our names, he's writing our life's stories, and he remembers us, is attentive to us at all times. So that brought great comfort to me in the midst of turmoil. There's a lovely verse in one of the prophets in the Old Testament where the prophet Nahum says, "The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him."
And there's a very real, massive difference in the way people tend to think of themselves and their identity today compared to what you're describing, where it's reliant on an enormous amount of sort of self-belief and dredging up whatever strength I can get from within myself, and also an ability to kind of construct a story for myself.
I think at first glance it looks pretty countercultural, but I don't think it's counterintuitive. I think this, all of us have this sense that we don't have the resources within ourselves to write our life stories as we like them to pan out. So what God offers people is a bit part, if you like, in a much bigger drama. And the postmodern objection to the meta-narrative or the big story of which you might be a part is this worry that you'll somehow be dominated, and it'll be a story that will harm people and be oppressive. And from my point of view, the wonderful thing about the Christian grand narrative, the story, is that it's about God saving the world through, not through some human brilliance and power, but through the weakness and folly of the cross. And then that then leads, that defining moment of the Christian's life, which was before they were born effectively, gives them an identity that gives meaning to our suffering, that gives purpose to our lives, that gives us a humility that otherwise we might not inhabit, and gives a moral direction to life. And in part, that's to do with our destiny. Bonhoeffer says this himself, actually. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the great German pastor and martyr, said that the most significant thing in my life is not the fact that I will die, that he was facing his own death, of course, but the fact that Jesus Christ died. And the most important thing is not what God does in my life, but what he did in the life of Jesus Christ, which then sets the course of my life, gives meaning and significance to it.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart. Brian Rosner's book is out now. It's Known by God, a biblical theology of personal identity. We'll put a link to it on our website, publicchristianity.org. Don't forget, you can listen to all our episodes of Life and Faith on our website too, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating or review. It helps people discover our show. Next week,
Uncle Tom's Cabin features two characters who are Christ figures. One is Uncle Tom, a slave, and the other is little Eva, who's a child. And this was a very radical statement to make, that the salvific power in Christianity comes from the weak, it comes from children, it comes from the oppressed. She did not believe that Christianity was about the power that ministers had or that elites had, but that the power of Christianity lay in the lowly people.